Marshall became obsessed with his investigation, and the strain it put on his family was just what Rafar's demons wanted. He began working late, missing dinners and evenings with his family, neglecting Kate, and all at a very crucial time for Sandy. Something was happening to her. She was changing, growing more distant, and Kate suspected that Sean and Professor Langstrat had a lot to do with it. Former college dean Eldon Strawn agreed to meet with Marshall and Bernice at his small farm an hour away from Ashton. Marshall consulted his notes. What about the college funds? Just what is the problem as you see it? Bankruptcy. Funds going out in all directions for years, but none coming in. And all of it juggled, covered up. I talked to Eugene Baylor, the secretary treasurer, but he wouldn't give me any straight answers. That's when I asked an accountant friend of mine to snoop around the accounting office and find out what was going on. He did. Bernice asked, can we have his name? Ernie Johnson. I'm afraid he's dead. Well, what about records? Did he leave anything written down? If he did, those records are lost. Why do you think I've remained silent? All right. So just how does our kind Professor Langstrat fit into all this? She's a guiding force behind it all, but she doesn't hold the ultimate power. Someone else higher up is controlling her. But you've no idea who? No. She has a weird, mysterious background, a lot of occult interests and involvements. I was surprised to see our student body taking such deep interest in her teachings, but even more surprised to see so many of the faculty getting involved. Who on the faculty? Strawn pulled out a hastily scrawled list that included names of faculty from almost every department. A lot of these people were hired recently and embraced the same mystical occult ideas. Quite simply, the college was taken over. How else could the vote for my resignation be unanimous? I used to have some very loyal friends on the Board of Regents, but no more. Let me have the names of your friends. I'd like to talk to them. Bernice started writing down the names as Strawn recalled them. Jake Abernathy had died. Morris James had gone bankrupt in a business and moved to another job. Fred Ainsworth, George Olson, Rita Jacobson had all left Ashton with no word as to where they'd gone. What about Ted Harmel? Marshall asked. Ted knew too much. When they found they couldn't control him any longer, they defamed him and chased him out of town with that ridiculous scandal. So was he really involved in occultism? Bernice asked. For a time, to him, it was a fascinating news story. But he kept getting more wrapped up in it, and I heard him say once that they had promised him great success with his newspaper because he was in their camp. But I guess he thought the truth was inviolable and the press would always be free, and when he began to print stories about the financial problems at the college, he definitely stepped over the boundary as far as the Regents were concerned. Marshall knew he was treading on thin ice as he hinted, Mr. Strawn, Ted wouldn't talk to me. He's scared. Scared of what? Of them, of the system that destroyed him, and I believe his fears are justified. Could you call him on our behalf? I can't promise anything, Marshall. I'd appreciate just the call. But, Marshall, you people watch out for yourselves. You're not invincible. None of us were. And you could lose everything if you make one wrong move. Be sure you know what you're doing. In the faraway, secluded valley, in the imposing stone ranch house, a middle-aged, roundly built man dressed in loose trousers and tunic sat Indian fashion in his office, his eyes closed, his breathing deep. The room was decorated with souvenirs from around the world. Swords, war clubs, African artifacts, religious relics, grotesque idols from the East. Without hearing a knock, the man spoke. Come in, Susan. The door opened silently, and in came a pale woman with long black hair. She was carrying a small book wrapped in brown paper. So you finally found it, if you weren't hiding it yourself. She replied, It was there all the time. We've been so busy packing that it got shoved over in a corner. He rose and put his arms around her waist. You've been so troubled lately. Why? The move to Ashton. You know I grew up in that town, and all I ever wanted was to get out of there. You can understand why my feelings are confused. He twirled her around and laughed playfully as he looked into her eyes. "Yes, I know. On the one hand, you have no desire at all for the town. And on the other hand, you sneak off to attend the carnival." She blushed a little and looked at the floor. "I was searching for something from my past. I needed answers for the future." "There is no past. I am your future." "Yes, I can see that. I couldn't before." He laughed and went behind his desk. "Well, good. Good, good. We don't need any more meetings held in hiding places behind a noisy carnival. You should have seen how embarrassed our friends were to have to meet there. But why did you even have to come looking for me? Why did you drag them along?" He sat at the desk and began handling a wicked-looking ceremonial knife. "Because, dear Susan, I love you, I am one in essence with you, but I do not trust you. You, dear Susan, share my life, my secrets, my purposes, but you are a woman of conflicting passions. I have to protect my interests." With that, he dropped the knife, point first, and it thudded into the head of a wooden idol.